In a remote region of Sardinia, there are 6 times as many centenarians as in any modern city, and men routinely live as long as women. What is their secret? The answer is what developmental psychologist and journalist Susan Pinker calls the village effect. Weaving together findings from the emerging field of social neuroscience with intriguing case studies, Pinker reveals the important role social bonds can play in educating our children, falling in love, aging well, and even negotiating business transactions. In her new book, The Village Effect, How Face-to-Face Contact Can Make Us Healthier, Happier, and Smarter, Pinker answers questions about why we need to build real human contact into our lives. And it's a pleasure to welcome Susan Pinker to the roundtable this morning.
Thank you for inviting me.
What brought you down this particular path?
Well, I started with my last book, The Sexual Paradox, which was about sex differences between men and women. And at the end of writing that book or researching it, I discovered that a couple of studies showed that women who had more integrated and complex social networks not only lived longer, but kept their marbles longer. They were less likely to have dementia. And this got me thinking, because there is a nearly universal gender gap in longevity of about 5 to 7 years. Women, on average, live longer than men. And I started to wonder, what are the biological roots of that, and is there a relationship between the fact that they put so much emphasis on their relationships and how long they live and how they live?
You look in the book and cite a statistic that says that in 1985, Americans had an average of 3 confidants. By 2014, they averaged fewer than 2. So over that 20-year period of time, what happened?
Well, one important change, cultural change, is that we're now more connected to each other via the internet. But as that statistic tells us, we've never been lonelier. So it's not only that we have less confidants. These are people that we can talk to intimately, who we can ask for a loan, who can help us when we're in a crisis. But we have fewer people that we talk to day to day because our lives have migrated online. So that's one change. We've also become a more mobile society, so we tend to move around quite a bit, and that's an increasing change over the last generation. There are many, many more people who live solo, so who live by themselves, which is a mixed blessing. So I think all of those combined are part of the picture.
It is interesting because you hear more and more young people, and I realize that this is anecdotal, but you do hear more and more young people who talk about the fact that they like to be alone, that they dislike other people. And that seems to be a shift.
Well, I think there's 2 types of being alone. There's the type of being alone that you, the kind of solitude you need to think and create and to kind of regroup. And that's very different than loneliness. Humans are a very social species. We need each other. It's a biological appetite, just like food and drink and sleep and sex. So we all need social contact, interpersonal social contact, face-to-face, even if we're shy or we're introverted or we need solitary time for whatever reason. So it's a fallacy that this can change from generation to generation, or that people who need less of that kind of time don't need any at all. We all need some. And so I think what you're hearing is that they want to be able to control who and how they connect with. And, of course, we're more and more capable of that now than ever.
So what happens, and you write about this in the book, what happens when people connect in person? What is going on scientifically?
Well, there's a whole biological cascade that's unleashed when you're face-to-face with somebody and interacting with them. And I'm not just talking about somebody you're close to, like your husband or wife or partner, although that certainly has a whole other meaning. But hormones are released, neurotransmitters are released, and these affect the way you think, the way you feel, the way you solve problems, and they affect your immunity and resilience. So one of the interesting studies that surfaced while I was researching the book is that Sheldon Cohen in Pittsburgh, I think, has discovered that essentially people who are isolated are much more susceptible to catching viruses like the common cold. It's a paradox because you think that the fewer people you shake hands with, the less you'll get sick, but it's actually the opposite. And even people who are shy and try to avoid social contact, they too are more vulnerable when they don't have it. They're more vulnerable to viruses, and they're more vulnerable to chronic illness as they age.
One of the things that I find interesting in the book is this idea of a village. So you talk about how we can create that village. But before we get to that point, does living in a village, does living in a city, does living in a neighborhood, does that change us as opposed to people who live in more rural settings?
Well, the village effect is really a metaphor for the social contact we need to survive and thrive.
Right.
And the village that you started with, the Sardinian village of Villa Grande, many of those villages, in mountain villages in Italy and Sardinia in particular, are constructed so that you actually have to meet each other. You can't really go anywhere without meeting your neighbors and your friends and your colleagues. And so some places, even if they're cities or workplaces, are now constructed to foster that kind of social connection. And the Googleplex is one of them. So you don't really have to live in a real village, but it's a way of thinking about how we go about our day. Are we isolated in our offices and in front of our screens for 12 or 15 hours at a time? Or is there a way for us to meet people as we move through our daily activities? Because if there isn't a natural way to bump into each other in the way that you can't avoid in a village, then it's something we have to craft ourselves for our own health and happiness and better learning. And so you can create that village effect, for example, by making sure you have face-to-face contact in very, very simple ways. For example, at work, instead of shooting emails to somebody down the hall, you can get up and walk there and interact with that person. Because we know from research that that synchrony that happens when you're face-to-face actually increases productivity. You can create your own village effect by making sure you have family dinners in your family as much as possible so that you connect face-to-face with your own kids and are not always communicating via a screen or, you know, through distance. You can make sure that you connect face-to-face with seniors. So, for example, in that Sardinian village, one of the reasons why people live so long is because there's absolutely no question of them being isolated as they age. The whole community is there buttressing them as they get older, and they're considered to be a huge resource, as they called it, a treasure for the community. That's not at all what we do in the West. I think that as people get older here, they're more and more isolated as their partners die and their friends die and their children move away. It becomes more and more difficult for them to have the kind of social contact daily and the kind of mutual respect and interaction that comes naturally in a place like Sardinia. So, I'm just talking a little bit about what I mean by the village effect and how we can create it in our daily lives.
One of the things in the book you mentioned and in the creation of that village effect, of the importance of creating diverse relationships.
That's one of the more surprising findings that I unearthed when I was researching this book. A lot of people think that what's important is just to have your close buddies around you. But actually, we need those diverse relationships, such as the person that you meet at the grocery store two or three times a week, or the person that you, your neighbors, or the people that you meet in your church or synagogue or mosque. And the reason we need them is because that diversity provides something completely different than your intimate relationships. And that those kinds of the middle range of relationships is what is starting to disappear because of the digital dilemma. Because, you know, digital technologies are so great for sharing information, and they're so efficient for things like buying books or ordering things over the internet or finding information, that the places where we used to cross paths, the libraries, the newsstand, the corner store, these things are starting to disappear, just the way our kind of cohesive communities disappeared during the automotive revolution in the 1950s and 60s when, you know, the city core started to, dissipate. So because of that, we have to focus more on creating those interactions. And the way you can do that is by, it sounds like really a dirty word, but by joining something so that you know that you are interacting with people who are different than you and who share a different viewpoint than you, who have different kind of banks of information, and who can step into the breach when you need help. So, for example, I personally used to exercise by myself, and then I realized, wait, I can kill two birds with one stone by exercising with a group. So I've changed my habits to not swim laps by myself at the Y, but to swim with a team. But anybody can do that depending on their interests. I've changed my habits from just kind of nose to the grindstone working, and I have solitary work as a writer, to making sure that I connect regularly with my neighbors, and not just with that inner core of, you know, your spouse, your children, your parents, your best friends. And this is particularly important for men because men tend to have larger networks, interestingly, but weaker ties. So unlike women on average, not every woman and not every man, but on average women tend to have smaller networks that are more tightly interwoven. So they're more likely to keep in touch with their friends and their family members on the phone, through email, by inviting them for dinner, by going to coffee, by going for walks, whereas men tend to have huge networks, maybe 300 or 400 people, where they might see them once a year, if that. And what's interesting is that if you don't see your contacts face-to-face, those contacts fade away, and your slot in their network gets replaced by somebody else.
Susan Pinker is our guest. The name of the book is The Village Effect: How Face-to-Face Contact Can Make Us Healthier, Happier, and Smarter. You just said about the word joining, of it becoming a dirty word. Is that because it brings with it commitment?
I think that's part of the picture. And another piece of the picture is that in our society, we value individualism and independence above all other values. And so being a joiner doesn't seem to have a positive kind of feeling or meaning to it. It means like, you know, it sounds like almost being a follower. But really the benefits of being part of a group are such that it predicts your mortality better than most of what we think is closely related to how long we live, like whether we smoke or not, or whether we exercise or not, or how much we drink, or whether we get the flu vaccine. It, essentially, when we look at meta-analyses of what predicts mortality, the strongest predictor is how integrated your social life is. And part of that is being a joiner, whether it's being involved in your community, knowing your neighbors, joining a religious group, joining a tennis club or a badminton club. And so, you know, one of the funny comments that I include in The Village Effect is this quip by George Burns that, you know, happiness is having a close-knit family, happy family living in another city. Right? Because everybody can, it resonates with everyone that you have no responsibilities if your family is far away. People can't bother you. They can't make demands. You don't have to deal with conflict. And you don't have to really empathize with anybody if you're not face-to-face with them. Or it's really, it's not, as I should say, in your face. But really, when you are with somebody face-to-face, there is no avoiding reading what's going on in their face, reading in their body language. And that kind of reciprocity or synchrony has a tremendous amount of benefit, interestingly, not only in the here and now. It improves our mood and happiness. It makes us better able to solve problems, but also through epigenetic effects far into the future for ourselves and for future generations, which seems kind of a bit sci-fi.
That idea of improvement in health. I'm reading the book and I come across a fact that being married significantly reduces our chances of developing gum disease. I realize I'm taking that out of context, but how does that fit in?
Well, it was part of a long, long list of the positive impact of being married.
Right.
So, you know, you're less likely to get gum disease, but you're less likely to commit suicide or be imprisoned or be in a car accident.
Right.
So I'm sure you remember this long list. And I included gum disease just because it was like a pause with like a what reaction.
That was exactly my reaction, right.
Exactly. And why does if it's true, why doesn't my dentist ask me how many times I interact with people throughout the day? And I think it's because social interaction being a physiological drive and a need has a very close correspondence to our general immunity. And we do know, for example, that there's a correlation between gum health and cardiovascular health. And that doesn't seem to be really closely connected either. But I think it's part of a general kind of array of positive effects that happens when people look after themselves. So people who are generally looking after themselves make sure that they floss and brush. They make sure they have a good diet and don't smoke, but they also make sure that they get out and see people regularly. It's as important to your health or more important than almost anything else that you can do. And interestingly, it's not a message that most people are aware of.
As we have discussed, technology is obviously a part of this. And one of the things that I thought was interesting is that even if you text your teenager a message of support, it has little impact on them. What has the impact is them hearing your voice.
Absolutely. And I think this is surprising because we expect that all forms of communication are created equal. And that's not at all the case. It would be like saying all ways of getting calories into your system are equal, or all ways of, you know, moving from one city to the next are equal. There are advantages and disadvantages of communicating, and one advantage of texting is the immediacy and the ease and convenience, but a disadvantage is that you lose a lot of the emotional valence of support. So, for example, if a parent is trying to communicate support to a child who's undergoing stress, and that's the study you're referring to because it was teenage girls who were being stressed out by having to solve math problems within a time limit in front of an audience. And afterwards, the parents who either saw or spoke to their daughters by phone had a greater impact on reducing their cortisol levels as a measure of their stress than the parents who either texted or did nothing. So texting had no effect on reducing their cortisol levels. And because the text is really not a form of emotional support, I would say it's like the difference between a real kiss and a little XX on the bottom of an email.
Are you optimistic that we can integrate, that we can bring this village effect into our lives?
I'm very optimistic because we have turned other, I would say, cultural tsunamis around in the past decades by force of will. For example, you know, at the beginning of the environmental movement, there was not much attention paid to the quality of our air and the ozone, you know, layer and the quality of our oceans. And 30 or 40 years later, we are paying close attention. You know, there are hybrid cars. People are walking and biking more. People are more, there's composting, there's recycling. There's been a huge cultural shift in the way we think about how we use the environment, which really wasn't part of the thinking of the previous generation. Similarly, for exercise, I know that, say, the previous generation, say, my parents and their friends, a lot of the men my father's age died before they were 60 because they never had any exercise in their day. Most of them smoked and had diets that were high in fat and salt. This has completely changed now. So I think through education and awareness of the science, people can slowly make small changes that have a huge impact.
The name of the book is The Village Effect: How Face-to-Face Contact Can Make Us Healthier, Happier, and Smarter. The book is published by Spiegel & Grau. It is a great pleasure to have had Susan Pinker on the program. Susan, thank you very much. Best of luck with the book.
Thank you so much, Joe. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you very much. Again, the title of the book is The Village Effect by Susan Pinker, published by Spiegel & Grau. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.